May it please the court. Sarah Beth Landau for Mr. Lipp. There are two issues before the court today. The first is whether the government demonstrated beyond a reasonable doubt that Adam Lipp willfully received a firearm while under indictment for a felony. The second is whether the district court erred in admitting extrinsic evidence that the components attached to the firearm that Mr. Lipp had were stolen, and further, that it may have been Mr. Lipp who was the culprit. Beginning with the sufficiency issue, in firearm cases, there's usually evidence of a false statement in the form of the gun purchase form, Form 4473. And in this case, we don't have any evidence of false statement with respect to that form because it was correctly and legally filled out by Mr. Lipp's mother, who was the purchaser of the firearm. Mr. Lipp at that time was under 21, so he was not allowed, per the gun store owner's testimony, to purchase the gun. He had to have a parent purchase it for him. Use of that gun by him was not illegal, according to the gun store owner. So the government, in terms of evidence in this case, is left with statements made before and after the receipt of the firearm, but not at the time of the receipt.
Now, there's evidence in this record, as I understand it, that when he was in, I guess it would be, I don't know if it was after he was indicted, but in any event, he signed the indictment, which reflects right on it that he can't possess a gun. There's evidence in this record that when he was in connection with the indictment that makes it illegal for him to own a gun or possess a gun, that that's on the face of the indictment and that he actually signed it.
Your Honor, I don't recall that.
Well, let me say that I wouldn't get this thing. This would not spring fully formed in the head of Zeus, okay? This must come from something that's in the record.
I understand, Your Honor. Putting that to the side, because I don't have the document in front of me to definitively establish one way or the other, but I will go back and look at that document.
I'm pretty sure that the record shows that he signed the indictment when he was released or whatever, that shows right on the face of it that he can't possess a gun.
Assuming that that's the case, that indictment was 8 months prior. We don't dispute that he received notice that he was under indictment, but that was 8 months prior to the receipt of the firearm.
If it's in here, and I think it must be, I don't know where I would have got it from otherwise, if it's in here, it's some evidence that he knew that he wasn't supposed to own a gun or possess a gun.
It is some evidence that he knew 8 months prior that he was not to possess a firearm. If whether someone with his age and experience can keep tabs 8 months later about whether he's permitted to possess a firearm is difficult at best to say. The evidence relied upon primarily by the government, though, are these false statements, and they are at best equivocal. And they're closer in time to the receipt, so they may be more probative, but if we actually look at the statements themselves, they're not terribly helpful in determining Mr. Lipp's willfulness. The first one is at the gun shop. Mr. Lipp informed that he went to the gun store three times, the gun store owner testified, and at one point he informed the gun store owner that he needed an upper receiver because the lower receiver was his father's and had been damaged falling off a truck. The government contended that that was false, but it's unclear in the record whether that's truly false because there's not enough information about how Mr. Lipp came into possession of the upper to require him to purchase a lower to complete an actual functioning firearm. So that is equivocal. Then, 4 days later, after 4 days after Mr. Lipp received the firearm, he'd already been encountered by law enforcement once and answered questions truthfully. The sheriff's deputy showed him how to sight the weapon. He was having some difficulty with that, handed the weapon back to him. He went on his way without incident. And then the next day, which now is 4 days after the receipt of the firearm, Mr. Lipp was encountered again by another sheriff's deputy who asked him some questions, and he provided answers that are arguably incorrect. And one of those answers, one of those questions to Deputy Castillo was, have you ever been charged with a felony? He said no. Have you ever been contacted by law enforcement, which Deputy Castillo admitted was a somewhat ambiguous question? And he said no. And then in response to Deputy Castillo's question, how did you get this firearm? He said, I had to save up money to buy it, which is, I think, equivocal, given that we know, although his mother made the purchase, it was Mr. Lipp who was interested in the firearm, had come into the gun store. It's not clear whether he saved up money like you would a car and you contribute money toward the purchase. There are not enough details for that to be even false. So given that we don't have information at the time of the receipt, and there are just these arguably false, maybe not false, statements before and after the receipt, it can't be said that the government proved the willfulness element beyond a reasonable
doubt. Now, how are we supposed to evaluate that evidence on appellate review?
Well, the court does...
A sufficiency challenge?
The court does review the evidence in the light most favorable to the verdict.
The verdict.
But if, as here, circumstantial evidence is equivocal and gives nearly equal support to guilty as well as innocent inferences, the court must reverse. The fact that the evidence is quite weak is demonstrated by the jury's questions in this case, which went right to the willfulness element. The jury asked, how old do you have to be to purchase a firearm in Texas? So they were trying to figure out if Mr. Lipp needed his mother there or what was going on. As it turned out, there was testimony about it, but that was not repeated to the jury. And then the jury asked, how old was Mr. Lipp when his mother purchased the lower receiver? Then this is where the jury really gets to kind of the heart of the matter, the willfulness issue. The jury refers to the willfulness element as something the law forbids, and they ask, is the something receiving the firearm, or is something doing something illegal after receiving the firearm? And then the final question, did he have to know he was breaking this specific federal law about receiving the firearm? The jury was clearly struggling with this willfulness element, and particularly in light of the improper evidence, which I'll discuss in a minute, the evidence was too weak to sustain the conviction, and it should be reversed. Turning to the 404B issue, the court has set forth the test for admitting extrinsic bad acts in Beecham, and that test requires that the government show that the evidence is relevant to something other than propensity or character. And this court has said before that that evidence must be strictly relevant. And more specifically, the court has said in Fortenberry and Sumlin that if the government can't show that the defendant actually committed the bad act, then it is not relevant and it should be excluded. And in this case, although there is a suggestion that Mr. Lipp possessed a stolen upper and that he may have been the one to steal it, the government did not show a reasonable jury, by evidence that a reasonable jury could accept, that he was indeed the culprit, or even that he knew that the upper that he possessed was stolen, and it should have been excluded on that basis alone. But even if the evidence is relevant, the government must make a further showing under 403 that the probative value of the evidence exceeds the prejudice. And in this case, given that he is charged with a relatively technical violation of the federal firearms statute, but is sort of suggested to be a culprit in a rather nasty home burglary, that probative value is very much outweighed by the prejudice in this case. As the judge himself noted, the jury was hearing a stolen firearm case, not just whether Mr. Lipp unlawfully received the firearm while under indictment for a felony.
What reason did the government give for offering that evidence?
They said motive. It explained why he would want the firearm. But the government already had evidence that he had a lower which wouldn't work without an upper. So why would they need to show the motive beyond that? It would be, if anything, cumulative about why he needed it. And it's not relevant to any element in the offense, the motive. And they admitted that to the jury. All it does is paint him as a bad character. It doesn't advance the ball in terms of their meeting their burden of proof. If you cut out all of Kenneth Bishop's testimony, they have no less proven their case. All it does is make Mr. Lipp look like a bad person, and that is prohibited. And in this case, you can see the unfair prejudice because there's a very good likelihood that the jury convicted him of being a bad guy who stole somebody's very expensive firearm instead of just being somebody who unlawfully received a firearm while under indictment for a felony. The government doesn't really contest that this was improperly admitted evidence. What they argue is that it was harmless. And given the weakness of the evidence, we can't say that it was harmless to admit this evidence on top of pretty equivocal statements and possibly an admonition 8 months earlier in the indictment. The instruction in this case is almost harmful rather than helpful. Mr. Lipp requested but did not receive an instruction to the jury at the time the 404B evidence was introduced, and then he requested further that the jury be instructed that they are not to consider any theft of the firearm or possession of stolen components, but the judge denied that request and instead gave a general request supplemented by specifics, which gave the jury, I think, an inaccurate impression of what they were supposed to consider. On page 119 of the record on appeal, there's an instruction titled, "Consider Only Crime Charge." And that sounds good, but when the instruction goes into what the jurors are to consider and not to consider, the court specifies, "You heard testimony relating to three indictments pending against Mr. Lipp. Mr. Lipp is also not on trial for these indictments. Neither are you concerned with the guilt of any other person or persons not on trial as a defendant in this case." The problem with this instruction is that it mentions the indictments, but not the stolen firearm components. So what it does is it gives the jury permission to consider the bad evidence for the bad purpose. And there's indication in the jury questions that they were wrestling with that very issue.
I was looking at the government's brief on the question I raised with you at the beginning. It says all three indictments identified the offenses as felonies, and Lipp signed all of the documents, citing GX 1, 2, and 3. Then it says all three indictments also contained a magistrate judge's warning admonishing Lipp that the offenses were felonies, and Lipp signed the warnings. So maybe that's what I'm...
Okay. I will check that, Your Honor. That's important. I don't recall that there was an admonition about firearms in those indictments, but I will check.
Thank you.
If the court has no further questions, thank you.
Okay, Ms. Booth.
May it please the court, counsel for the appellant. Good morning. My name is Patty Hubert Booth, and I am an assistant United States attorney assigned to the Victoria Division of the Southern District of Texas. I'm here to assure you that the evidence is sufficient to establish that Mr. Lipp willfully received this firearm while he was under indictment. Mr. Lipp, as this case began, his attorney allowed, without objection, the admittance of governments 1, 2, and 3. Those three sets of documents showed that Mr. Lipp was indicted for three different felonies. Theft of over $1,500, which alleged in the indictment that it was a 2007 Toyota 4Runner. The second charge was tampering with evidence, which showed that, or alleged that, he provided a false bill of sale. And then the third indictment was unlawful possession of an instrument used for theft, a criminal instrument used for theft. Along with that, these indictments were waivers of arraignment, where it indicates at least on eight different places that he is under indictment, Also, he signed three of these, he and his attorney, so that's 24 times it was referred to the fact that he was under indictment. He signed his bond papers. He signed his order of reset, two orders of reset, along with his defense attorney. Now, the last order of reset that was signed, Your Honor, was on January the 20th of 2011. This defendant, Mr. Lipp, had been arrested December the 9th of 2009. He wasn't indicted by the state until and arrested there and bonded out, where he signed his magistrate warnings and got his bond papers. Then he was again arrested in July for two felony offenses, and then in September, where he waived his arraignment on the indictment and signed saying that he understood all of these things. Now, the allegations in this case happened only 30 days after the time that he had his second reset order in court with his attorney. So he fully knew that he had been indicted or that he had felony charges against him.
Yeah, now let me ask you, do any of these papers that you're referring to that he signed, though, I had the idea that they had a warning on them that he couldn't possess a gun.
I did not see that, Your Honor.
Okay, I don't know where I got that from.
I did not see that. In addition, when he was arrested on March the 1st of 2011, prominently displayed on his refrigerator was his reset orders, where he had just been in court on the 20th of January, and it was reset for...
Counselor, I'm prepared to wholly agree that he knew he was under indictment. I think the question is whether or not he knew that he wasn't supposed to possess a firearm while under indictment, and that despite that knowledge, he willfully possessed it. I think that's what the real concern is. You're getting to that.
Yes, sir.
All right.
Yes, sir. There were three reasons why you can infer from his activity that he understood that he was not supposed to receive a gun while he was under indictment. The first one, of course, were the series of or the story that he told the gun shop owner. He went in for the first time to the gun shop owner on the 21st of February, and he went to 22nd, and he went to the 23rd. But he actually visited that place four times. He knew exactly what he wanted. He wanted an AR-15, and he told the gun shop owner that the reason that he wanted he was looking for an AR-15 is that his father's gun had been damaged falling off the back of a truck. Why would someone make up a story like that? Why would you not want the gun owner to know exactly who was going to receive that weapon? Because he knew that he was not supposed to receive a weapon. Now, February 21st, the same day that he went in for the first time to ask about the AR-15, was the day, the approximate date, of the burglary of Mr. Bishop's home, where this very expensive high-end weapon had been stolen. AR-15 that had this a fantastic scope and laser beam and all of these things attached to it on its upper receiver. He went in the 21st, 22nd, 23rd, made up this story, and then on the 24th he brings in his mama late in the evening. Mr. Bishop believes that it was already closing time. It was already after 6. Brings her in. She fills out the 4473. Why in the world couldn't Mr. Bishop know that this weapon was going to go to Mr. Lipp? Because Mr. Lipp knew that he was under indictment and he knew that he couldn't receive it. And that's why he told the story there. Now, another thing that is not mentioned in the brief, but was evidence that was offered, was a tape, I think it was government's exhibit number 22, where Mr. Lipp is speaking to his mother on the phone while he's incarcerated. And the mother actually tells him, well, you weren't convicted of a felony. He said, no, I wasn't supposed to receive a weapon. And she says, well, who'd you receive a weapon from? And he said, well, Mama, I received it from you, something to that effect. And she goes, I asked you about that night. And then you hear him thud on the wall. This is a tape recording of a visitation meeting that they had. So Mama was confused. Mr. Lipp wasn't confused. And Mama had asked him about it. And that was government's exhibit number 22. One more thing. The next thing was that after he received this gun on the 23rd, when his mama bought this gun, the 24th, he encounters law enforcement out. He's already got the gun put together. Now, Mr. Martin testified that he puts these guns together for free for people, but Mr. Limp did not bring that. He knew how to do it. He already put that gun together when he got it on the 23rd. The 27th, a few more days later, he's encountered again by law enforcement, by Officer Castillo. At that point, Officer Castillo asks him, have you been convicted? I mean, have you been charged with a felony? And he goes, no. Have you had any contact with the police? No. Why would you tell that? Why would you tell that lie except that you've received a firearm, you know you're not supposed to have it because you're under indictment, and that's why you lie to law enforcement? The third thing is that when Mr. Lipp is arrested on March the 1st of 2011, a few days after that second encounter with law enforcement, he has in his bedroom two other weapons, a rifle, a shotgun. There was testimony from the ATF agent that there were three other types of ammunition, at least three other types of ammunition there in his room. So this is a man that knows how to acquire weapons because he acquired weapons and ammunition. Now, the 404B situation, Your Honor, the reason I brought up all the stuff about the felonies is because when this evidence went in, the defense attorney did not stipulate that he had indictments. What he did was he spent like four or five pages on the record, page 172 to 180, talking to the district clerk about all these documents. Because he had this, his strategy in trying this case was confusion, contradiction, and consultation. And so he was using the district clerk to show that some of the paperwork was misfiled, and so confusion reigned, so to speak. And in this situation, he brought great attention to the documents that were in the record. Many of the things that were in these papers were much more heinous, much more damning than the absolute slight mention or the mention that that upper that was attached to the lower might be stolen. Counsel made a statement that the judge said, well, now we're trying a stolen weapon. He made that statement, Judge Rainey made that statement in response to the fact that the defense attorney, when he was cross-examining one of the witnesses, brought up information that the government had not been able to bring up about the Kabuto tractor that had been used to pull the safe through Mr. Bishop's home. And he made a big issue about that tractor, which then, and the keys to that tractor, which then the government came back and wanted to say, all right, when we arrested Mr. Lipp on March the 1st, he had two sets of Kabuto tractor keys in his truck. And so the defense attorney had brought up, had highlighted all of the burglary information to which the government, after the door was open, came back in. So we have the defense attorney highlighting all the information on the burglary. We have the defense attorney highlighting all of the information on the three different charges that this defendant was indicted on. And now they come in and complain that the mere reference that the upper this fancy upper, high-end, I believe is how everybody testified to it, this upper was stolen is somehow so prejudicial that would cause for a reversal. After they have caused this huge amount of harm on other the two end of the spectrum. Now, this particular information about that upper being stolen was on the exact day or one or two days that the day, on the day that Mr. Lipp went in to buy the lower. So it was the proximity to this offense is why it was offered and accepted into evidence. And the second thing is that the motive, the jury got to see why it was that Mr. Lipp braved committing this other crime, receiving a weapon while under indictment. Why he braved that? Because he had this beautiful, expensive, high-end upper that he wanted to buy a lower for, an AR-15, so he could put them together. And so that information about that upper was simply to show the motive of why he would commit this crime. Generally, we don't know that, but we know it in this case.
How does that help convict? How is that relevant, since motive is not really part of the offense?
It was relevant, in my humble opinion, as just a simple trial attorney. It helped the jury understand why this person committed this crime, which we hardly ever get that kind of information. And so the motive of why you would brave getting indicted again, getting in trouble again, is because this upper was such a fine piece of equipment that he needed the lower to attach to it. And that is the reason. But it seems harmless information when you consider it in the light of the information that was brought out by the defense attorney. The Kabuto keys being found in the defendant's truck was information that was in response to the questions that the defense attorney had asked and opened the door to. All of this information about these three indictments that he had was highlighted and brought out by the defense attorney because he was hoping to use that strategically to prove contradiction, confusion, consultation, which was the theme of his defense. I'll certainly answer any question or attempt to that you might have for me.
One question I have, opposing counsel has indicated there are different ways to interpret some of the actions that you have talked about or whether it showed knowledge or not. Does it matter what law he thought he was violating, if he thought he was too young to receive, if he thought there was some other problem, does that matter? Or is it merely sufficient that he knew he was acting unlawfully in receiving a weapon? Did he need to know it's because he was under indictment that he should not be receiving, or could he have thought he was breaking some other law and that would still sustain the conviction?
Your Honor, I do not know the answer to that question.
I don't either, which is why I asked.
It wasn't unlawful for him, was it? I mean, apart from his indictment.
It was not unlawful for him to...
Not unlawful for him to have the gun.
Right. Mr. Bishop testified that he wanted permission from, if they would have been under 21, he wanted permission from a parent. But that's not what he said when he went into Mr. Bishop. He just told Mr. Bishop his father's gun had been injured and that they were trying to replace his father's gun. And there's absolutely no testimony about a father. In fact, he lived in the trailer with his mama. And when they did the arrest of him, they found a bill of sale where that particular weapon that had been purchased on the 23rd had been sold earlier that same day as the warrant that the warrant was executed had been sold to someone who the agents testified they could not find and there was no information about. But there was a false bill of sale explaining why that gun wasn't at that house anymore.
But he would have been under 21 at the time he initially went in to the gun store.
There was no evidence to that during the trial, but he was.
All right.
I didn't hear the question or the answer. What was that?
How old?
How old was he?
Right. There was no evidence how old he was, but he was 20.
The federal firearms law prohibits the licensed dealer mm-hmm. from selling the gun to somebody under 21. It does not prohibit him from owning the gun, and it doesn't prevent the dealer from selling the gun to his mother and the mother giving it to him right there on the scene. It doesn't prohibit that either. So the problem, he could own the gun. That wasn't the difficulty, apart from his indictments.
Yes. The indictments were the problem. And he knew that.
And he knew it, yeah.
Right. And he knew that.
All right. I think we have your argument.
Thank you. It was a great pleasure. An honor.
Ms. Landau.
Judge Graves is exactly right. The case boils down to not whether he was on notice that he was under indictment, but whether at the time he received the firearm, he knew he was not allowed to receive that firearm. I think that the law is unclear about how specific the specific intent is to answer Judge Southwick's question about whether it's enough that he knew that his behavior was illegal or whether he needed to know that his being under indictment prevented him from legally receiving a firearm. But in this case, the only bad act of which there was evidence are these indictments. The indictments are the only evidence the government put forward in terms of what would make the receipt illegal. So functionally, there probably is not a difference between those two things. But the law is unsettled as to how specific the specific intent is.
Well, I think he needs to be aware, would you agree with this, that his conduct is unlawful and he can't be mistaken. If he thought he was too young to receive it, for example, or to buy it, that's not good enough. He's got to be aware in some way that he's breaking an actual law that exists.
Correct. I would agree with that, Your Honor. And with, let's see here. And the government asks why would he tell these things to the gun store owner or to Deputy Castillo, but it doesn't really equate that because you make a statement that is inaccurate, even if it is inaccurate, which a lot of these statements have not really been shown to be inaccurate, people make mistakes when speaking to law enforcement for all kinds of reasons that are unrelated to the fact that they know they're under indictment and they're not supposed to have this firearm. That's a huge leap to make. I have myself been pulled over and misstated things to a police officer, not because I was lying, but because I was nervous, because I was late for work and I was about to get a ticket. It's hard to say. Maybe he knew he was 20, he wasn't 21, and he wasn't sure if he was supposed to be using the firearm. There's just not enough evidence here. It's bootstrapping to say that because you make a false statement, not at the time of receipt, that is not, may or may not be known to be false to the speaker, that somehow indicates you knew that you were breaking the law when you received the firearm a few days earlier.
What do you say to the opening the door argument that we just heard?
That's where I was going to go next.
Glad
Your
I
Honor.
Asked that question.
I appreciate it. One, the government abandoned that argument on appeal by not briefing it. Two, there is no opening of the door. Mr. Bishop's testimony is the giant opening of the door. We had to put on something to indicate that it was somebody other than Mr. Lipp who stole that firearm. The government is incorrect to say that we opened the door because the witness actually volunteered that information about the Kubota keys. And if you look at the record, what Mr. Morales, my colleague, asked was, do you usually leave your keys in the tractor? And in response to that question, the witness volunteered that all Kubota keys fit all tractors. So to say that he opened the door, the horse is out of the barn, to mix metaphors at this point, and a trial counsel had to do something with that information. And knowing that there's this hint that Mr. Lipp was possessing stolen firearm components, and now there's a hint that he stole the firearm components himself, he had to do something with that information that was constructive. To say that he opened the door kind of misses the point that the door was open a while ago by permitting this testimony by Mr. Bishop. The government has not offered one single case permitting this kind of evidence, this evidence of a worse crime than what he's charged with in federal court, with such weak basis. They have to show that he actually committed the offense, and they didn't do it. We didn't open the door. We objected to the introduction of any testimony about it. We asked for a limiting instruction. We asked for an instruction of the jury in the moment. We got none of that. So to say that we opened the door is, I think, aggressive at best, which is probably why it doesn't appear in the brief. Also, the government mentioned a false bill of sale. There's absolutely no record evidence that the bill of sale was false in any way. There was information about a bill of sale. There was no further information about its correctness or falsity. And the government also made mention to us opening the door as to the indictments in this case and not stipulating. There's nothing requiring Mr. Lipp to stipulate that he was under indictment. And the jury was properly charged that they were not supposed to consider that indictment as evidence against him in this case. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.